The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Now, I want to talk to Marion. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Thanks for taking our call this morning. You wrote us an astonishing email, if I may say so, after you heard Olivia Staunton talk to us last week, who was telling us about her poor brother, who had been the victim of a hit and run, and they still don't know who did that. Can I ask you, Marion, when you listened to that story, was it hard for you to listen to that story, or did you just keep going?
No, it stopped me on my tracks. It was very hard to listen to, and it brought me right back to my own family's situation quite some years ago, but it never really changes, no matter how many years ago it is, you know.
There were nine of you in the family, is that right?
Yes.
Growing up on the Falls Road in Belfast, which we're all very well familiar with. Would you tell us a little bit about what happened and bring us back to that day, if you don't mind?
Well, on the 12th of January 1987, my three brothers and my brother's brother-in-law went to the local GAA club to watch some GAA, the Sunday game. And they were there about an hour, and they decided they'd just go home again. And this was in the local GAA, and it's like an extension of the Falls Road, so it's like the houses have been built, so the country's not, you know, it's not countryside anymore. But sure. The roads were still small, and so they came out of there, and they crossed the road, and it was quite a small road, and they were crossing two by two, you know, two just behind the other. And a car came careering up the road and knocked the four of them down. And my three brothers the two of them were knocked like 30 feet in the air and down the road. And I got a phone call the next morning to say that two of the three of them were in intensive care. For Eamon, Fergus and Vincent were my three brothers. Yeah. The youngest one, Vincent, had minor injuries, and the other two, Fergus and Eamon, were in intensive care. And Fergus lived 3 weeks. He had a head injury, never regained consciousness, and he died on the 6th of February, which was a big blow to all of us, but we didn't get time to grieve for him because Eamon was still in the next room in intensive care.
How old was Fergus, Marion? Do you mind me
asking? He was 29.
Okay. And Eamon was just down
31.
Okay.
Well, he had his 31st birthday in intensive care. He was getting better. He had multiple organ injuries, and he was, you know, well, the Royal Hospital in Belfast were amazing. They did everything they could. He was getting better. He'd been intubated. He'd started to sit up. He was talking a little bit. He was having little sips of juice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after Fergus died, like, Vincent looked at us all when we were standing outside intensive care waiting to go in to see Eamon and saying, look, Fergus is dead. We can't do anything about that. We're going to have to work really hard on getting Eamon well. And things were doing okay, and then it took a downturn, and he got septicemia. Mm. And because he had so many injuries, they couldn't figure out where the septicemia was coming from. So in the end, on the 16th of March, they told us they were going to amputate his leg because they thought that's where the infection was coming from. So they amputated his leg on the 17th of March, and he died on the 28th of March.
Oh, no.
And my father always felt that that was the final obscenity for Eamon, because both Eamon and Vincent were marathon runners.
And he couldn't, the mere thought of such a part of him being taken away.
They can do wonderful things now, but in 1987, losing your leg was pretty devastating for anybody, you know. So we think he stopped fighting. He also knew that Fergus was dead. They had said, you know, that they felt it was better that he was told. But when he was told, he said, yeah, he knew, because Fergus was in the room next door in intensive care and the light went out in the room. So he said he knew. And between that and the amputation of his leg, we think he stopped fighting. So, you know, we then tried to proceed to grieve for both of them. Mm-hmm. which was very difficult. And, you know, everybody has their own way of grieving. But it just goes on and on and on. And everybody's gone on with their lives. And we've had families and children and grandchildren. And But when, you know, when we get together as a family now, there's just this huge, big void that never can't be replaced. And, like, you know, when you say hit and run to people, or you say somebody was knocked down in the car, people are sympathetic and they say that's awful and they move on with their lives, which is what people do. But when they didn't die outright, we often wondered would have been better off if they had died straight away. But that doesn't serve any purpose either,
no,
you know.
No, but I'm assuming it haunts you.
Yes, it does.
And the story haunts you. If we all paused for a moment and thought, especially if we have brothers and sisters, if one of them died at that age, and in those circumstances, we'd be ruined. And then if we thought we'd lose two...
Would just be uncomprehensible.
That's
what
I'm thinking.
One was bad enough, but to lose both of them. And then Eamon, the second one that died, left three small children.
Okay.
And he was buried on a Tuesday, and his little girl was three on the Thursday.
Yeah. There are no words for that sort of tragedy.
And I did, sorry, Olivia, did you say that girl was called?
Yes, Olivia Staunton.
Yeah, Olivia. I just thought, you know, I thought it was very sad that she thought that she had hoped that somebody would write an anonymous letter and say, it was me, I know I did it. And yet, the guy that knocked my brother down was caught. He tried to get his car fixed locally and said he had hit a tree. And the mechanic got suspicious, and he knew my oldest brother, and he told him, so he went to the police, and the guy was got. But he went to court with a social worker and said he had problems, and he got a 12-month suspended sentence and fined £200.
Suspended sentence?
Suspended, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, when you see the devastation that was left, and it wasn't even just my family, it was, you know, because there were so many of us, you know, we had so many friends and relations, and, you know, it devastated so many people. And I don't think people have that realization. Mm.
Did you know the man?
No, he was local, but we only knew him to see.
And what became of him?
Oh, well, he was in jail a few years later for another crime he had committed, and he got out of that. And then it's very bizarre, but he committed suicide. And the day he committed suicide was the day we were burying my father.
Oh, good Lord, what a bizarre...
And somebody came in and told us that, and I used bad language and said, I wish he would go away and let me bury my father in peace. I didn't want to hear his name lifted.
And
you know, but it's such a small community, you know, that...
I understand.
But it's just the trail of disaster that is left behind. And never... that can never be repaired, you know. I mean, Vincent, my youngest brother, the one that survived, he described it as losing both his arms when they died, because they were always together. They were known as the three wise men because they were always together. But, you know, and he had a young family as well. Did his best to get on with his life, and he did, and he does. But, you know, for quite some time afterwards, he would go missing in the middle of the night, and he was found in the graveyard.
He was demented with grief.
Yeah, he was found in the graveyard at least two or three times, setting up the grave. And you have to remember, this was Belfast when the trouble was still on. So if the army had to come across him, he mightn't have got out of the graveyard either.
What was your mother's take on all of this? And in fact, particularly if your mother was trying to bury your father, and then hearing that news about the man who committed the initial crime on your family.
Well, we didn't tell my mother when we heard that this guy had committed suicide. We didn't tell my mother that the day my father was buried.
Okay.
But my mother, she was a very sterling woman, and she was Catholic, but I always thought she was one of the most Christian people that I had ever met.
Yes.
She kept going. She kept going. But I remember the day my second brother died, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. So my husband and myself took our three small children to a shopping centre to walk around to do something. And I remember walking around the shopping centre with the tears rolling down my face and my three-year-old boy walking, toddling in front of me. And all I could think was, my mother has lost two sons. I only have one. What would I do if I lost him? And that has never left me either, you know. But my mother worried about the anger and the hatred that, you know, people felt for towards this guy that knocked them down. And yet, she always felt that that hatred would eat you up if you didn't let it go. And in the end, before many years later, but in the end, my mother actually had masses said for him, the guy that knocked them down.
Did she really?
Yes, because she felt that, again, as I say, that the hatred would eat them up, eat us up if we didn't let go. And unfortunately, she said she'd rather be the son of, she'd rather be the mother of her sons than the mother of somebody who used a lethal weapon to kill and ruin so many lives.
Do you remember Gordon Wilson?
I do indeed. I do indeed.
It sounds like your mother.
Yes. Yes.
You mean to forgive in the face of unforgivable acts is, as you say, she, whatever about a Catholic, a stunning Christian.
Oh, she was one of the most Christian people I have ever met in my life.
Yeah.
You know, but it's as I say, it's when people say, oh, somebody was knocked down or somebody was speeding, it doesn't sound trivial, but it doesn't just seem to...
It's neat.
Yes, it's tidy.
It's tidy for us to
and
say
it was
to
all
you.
Very messy.
Yeah. And now, exactly, it just has that lovely abstract sort of like hit and run
and
car accident,
on.
And that it suits us as the people trying to sympathise with you.
Yes.
But you're in the middle of it.
Yeah, and now let me say whether it was my family situation or Olivia's, or people living in a war situation,
yeah,
or people who lose loved ones in unforeseen circumstances. Nobody has the monopoly on grief. My grief is not more important than the next person's or that. But it's just when you were talking about the topic of hit and run, I just felt that's exactly as you said, you know, it is so neat and tidy. And the devastation and the trail of disaster that's left behind is indescribable.
Your sister Eileen got in touch with us.
Yes, she sent you an email after
I did.
She
sent us an email. I mean, obviously, the impact of all of your, on your family. She was 21. All she wanted to do was travel, but everything stopped.
Well, she was living in Dublin at the time as well, because I'd been here quite a while. She'd come to Dublin to move on and get a career, and she was doing quite well, and she thought she'd travel and get the life experience of that. And then the morning we got the phone call, she went home that day. I went home eventually, but she went home that day. And she stayed home. She never left. And she went home to my parents. And she stayed there. And with my other sisters, she nursed my father till he died. And, you know, her life disappeared as it should have, you know, as she had planned it out for somebody that was 21, 22 and everything ahead of her. And it just never happened.
Everything changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably kind of probably not a very nice observation, but I often find when people are robbed of somebody so young that a little bit of a light goes out in them.
Yes, it does.
And I'm not saying that it finishes people off altogether, but I just feel sometimes you meet people who've suffered this unspeakable grief, and you can't help but think, you know, if everyone in your family that or people you love are candles, just one was put out, or two in your case.
Well,
and it's a different kind of light. I don't know if that's gobbledygook, but it just
yes, it is, and as I say, you know, you're marked for life.
I think so,
and everything you do in your life is, you know,
informed by that.
By that, it is. And now, I mean, it was 1987, and my children were 3, 5, and 6 at the time.
Mm.
But my children have grown up, and other children in the family, the grandchildren it would be, have grown up still knowing Fergus and Eamon because they're talked about all the time. And we talk about, you know, something silly that happens or a great football match or, you know, you'd say, oh, Eamon would have loved that, or, you know, Fergus would have been amused
keep,
at that, you know.
Keep the story. Do me a favour, Marion, would you?
Yeah.
Tell me something beautiful about Fergus and Eamon.
Oh, well.
Start with Fergus.
Fergus was the quiet one and everybody wanted to mind him. And he was he was dark and had very dark brown eyes, lovely black hair. And the other two hated him because they were going bald. And he didn't really care how he looked. You know, he just muddled on through and he always looked good. And Vincent, particularly the younger one, there was always rows between those two because Fergus couldn't be bothered buying fancy clothes and Vincent was dressed to the nines and he used to steal Vincent's clothes. So there was murder with that. But he had a wicked sense of humour and he was wonderful with the small children. And all the women called him Dimitri.
Okay, so he had that dark features about
him. Oh, yeah, and you know, and quiet and gentle, you know. Yeah. Eamon was, he was 6 foot odd. He had red hair and he was known to his friends as Rooster. And he could have went to the pub and sat in company. Because we were all so close together, we all went out together with our partners and husbands, wives, whatever. But Eamon could have held court and he could have told stories like... do you know the way Billy Connolly would have went off on a rambling story before he got to the punchline?
Yeah.
Eamon could do that. And he could keep it up for like 10 or 15 minutes and everybody would be waiting for the punchline. But he never lost their attention, you know?
Yeah.
And he was wickedly funny.
Well, you know? I feel like you've introduced your brothers to us today.
Okay.
That was lovely.
Okay.
Thank you, Marion.
Yeah, they're still around.
They're still around. They're still in the air. And they joined us here in a way this morning, which I think is kind of gorgeous too. Thank you for telling us your story. That wasn't easy, Marion, but I think it's important and we appreciate your time.
Not at all. Only delighted to be given the opportunity and just for people to realise that cars can be lethal weapons.
That's a true story. Well, the best of luck to you and to your family and thanks to Eileen also for her email. And mind yourself and hopefully we'll cross paths someday.
Thank you very much indeed.
Take care, Marion.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. 9 minutes to 10.